this week, this day, October 6th, 2019, in Fancy Ramen, episode 133, we talk about indiscriminate murder, underhanded sports, solely right foot.
Some Sonomian files by... A dickhead untitled goose game. Some Borderlands 3.
And then I can't stop talking about Fire Emblem Three Houses, and we dip back into Divinity Original Sin for just a little bit more updates.
Cue music.
All this and more. Yeah. How is getting strangled, Cookie?
Getting strangled was a lot of fun. Hopefully it looked good.
You had the best acting chops out of everyone, actually. So
I'd believe that.
All those months of D&D, baby!
So there was a funny point because Cookie had pointed out in the midst of us recording this short film, a 48-hour short film festival that I might elaborate on later, that the two victims that were staged out for this particular part of the scene were both black males.
Yes.
What? They they killed the black guy yet again.
Not just one in this short film. Two.
But there's a twist.
But it's okay, because one of the black guys was a red herring. Good news, it was not me.
Man, you just... Some of those tropes are inescapable, it seems.
Yep. When your producer calls and says, hey, I need you on set in an hour, you're going to get strangled by a backpack. You just say, okay, I'll be there, boss.
Like, yeah, I'm there, man. Is it a Fjall Raven? Are we... What kind of strap are we talking about? I'm going to get prepared. I'm going to be method about this.
So get this, like... If it hasn't already become evident just because I'm involved, like the production of this 48-hour film festival also demands like a very hectic, it causes a very hectic production if you do anything remotely ambitious at all, because you have 2 days to work on it. And with our work schedules as well, that means more like you have 36 hours plus sleep time involved. But what makes this so incredible is that I like was trying to think of anyone that might want to participate in this filming of in this filming and, you know, basically get not much out of it, which I do. I totally owe Cookie a six pack. But I asked Cookie, like, hey, can you be here like around three, give or take 30 minutes? And then we start filming, and I'm like, in the back of my head, I'm like, okay, I'll contact him as soon as I know we're ready for him. But technical issues arise and stuff, and we're going a little slow on progress. And Cookie suddenly shows up, and it's not until after we film all of his parts when it occurs to me that, like, wait, I never told Cookie where we were filming.
You gave me the generalness of... an escape room
by your house,
132nd and Center.
Yeah,
and I was like, Google, take the wheel.
And then you discovered there's a new escape room you haven't been to in Omaha. So,
indeed. So once my family gets all together, we'll solve the one room they have.
And hopefully they'll have more rooms up soon. I know, like they're in the construction phase for a lot of that stuff right now. Like in between us filming, there was actually like construction sign and power tool usage going on in the background.
Oh, nice. So I meant to ask if he has to come up with like the puzzles or if there's like a escape room Discord channel.
There is a website that actually sells escape room puzzle things. I don't think it necessarily gives you like the thematic puzzles built out. Like here's a, I had to like intentionally not give away one of his puzzles because I don't know like what escape room puzzles typically are, not having been in one and only playing video games with them, which I'm imagining are way different. It's not like you go and find like a clown trap box puzzle for sale at a website, I'm assuming. I think it's more just like you find the contraptions and like the, you know, color combination safe, that sort of stuff. And then you have to like customize it to your desire.
Make it to your theme.
That said,
you build the puzzle around it is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Right?
But I imagine that like the original escape rooms were all done with ingenuity. Like someone, you know, taking pieces of plywood together and suddenly making a puzzle out of it.
Yeah.
I think this goes like this. And yeah, we'll just put an X right here and say that you got to figure out what it does. We'll use this first group of people as like a test batch. Even though there are no answers to any of these things, we'll find their most creative solutions.
It's got to be like a Minecraft thing, right? Where you just put one piece of wood here and one piece of wood there, and suddenly you have a puzzle.
Exactly.
Funny enough, though, like as we were getting closer to like the late evening, Riley of this escape room, I'm not going to mention it. I don't know if it's necessarily kosher or not to his escape room, or he got a booking for 9:30. And so it was like 7:30 PM and we're like, well, I guess we can't shoot short or late then, because we need to pack things up and allow the escape room to do its business.
Nice. I was going to say, you don't want to do a shameless plug and hopefully get our first sponsor.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Are we supposed to be recording this?
I mean, I have been.
And if not, you're fine. Oh, you were.
Too.
Wow.
Yes.
Amazing.
That's why it took a second for me to answer the how it was being strangled, because I was like, wait a second, let me record this.
This is audio gold. We can't lose this.
They strangled their only black guy.
Luckily, like, the body count is diverse by the end of the short. Diverse.
Yep.
If you're going to kill, kill indiscriminately.
Exactly. The Genghis Khan method. Don't go that Hitler method where he was just targeting gypsies, Jews, and gays.
Yeah, people think more kindly and highly of Genghis Khan after the fact, right? Compared to Hitler.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Genghis Khan didn't care. You were black, Muslim, white. We also
share
Mongolian.
More.
Yeah.
Yeah. We also share more ancestry with him on average than.
Thanks, yeah, man.
This is Fancy Ramen episode 133, a podcast where we kind of talk about video games.
A Genghis Khan enthusiast podcast.
I'm pro Genghis.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of the Golden Horde. Big fan.
Gone!
What have you guys been up to? Neil, it sounds like you have a pretty exciting, hectic weekend.
Yeah, if it's not evident from like late podcasts and so forth, when I start getting busy with work, like everything around me has to kind of take a backseat.
For obvious reasons.
Yeah, and this 48-hour film festival challenge kind of like came up out of nowhere and I completely forgot about it. I was told maybe like a week in advance and I was like, yeah, okay, I can help out. And then, like, I always forget that it's, regardless of how you plan it, and regardless of whether or not you think the scope is ambitious, it always turns out to be more ambitious than, at least I personally think, is necessary. And it becomes, you know, a day and a half of shooting, which, like, I'm sure it's gonna do better as a result of that hard work, but, like, I generally use my weekends as rest and relaxation, and having like a relatively stressful situation there means I'm just going to be even more like drained of my Donald Trump battery cells by the end of the week. But that's been the story of my last couple weeks though. So what about you guys?
I'll let Scott go first.
Okay. Have I been up to much? No, I hyperextended my shoulder playing tennis. I've been like indoors doing mostly nothing for the past couple days. I was planning on playing a lot of tennis, but it got to the point where I like couldn't toss the ball to serve without excruciating pain. So I like had to quit cold turkey.
Wait,
did you get a refund?
On on my big fancy new tennis membership.
Yeah.
No, it's for a whole year. So
okay.
I'll recover. I'm mostly...
I don't know, Scott. You're getting kind of old. Recovery takes longer and longer.
It does. That's true. But I'm at like... I think I'm probably at like 90% now. I do love to try and figure out the scale of health. Is it actually like logarithmic or is it linear? I think 90% works either way. Like I'm well, but I still wouldn't play today just at risk of like exacerbating it, not being completely healed.
It's your offhand.
It's my offhand. It's not even the one I use to swing the racket, really. I mean, I have a two-handed backhand, so I do swing the racket with it 45% of the time, but no, it's the other shoulder than the one that's doing all of the swinging and the heavy work. And I don't exactly know how I got the injury or how I like essentially started it, but I played through it to the point where I definitely made it a lot worse than it was. So it was one of those things where I like took an Advil because I had a little bit of pain. We're talking like 2 on the pain scale. I was like, oh, this is a little uncomfortable. I'm gonna have an Advil before I play this doubles seminar tonight. And then went in, started playing. The Advil wore off, and I was like, I'm at a 6. Like, I'm in a lot of pain. I played through the rest of that set because we were more than halfway through. And then I was like, I'm at an 8. I'm about to cry. So I stepped off the court and like have been nursing my injury ever since. And so I'm getting back from that, but it's been incredibly lazy around the house since then. I couldn't even do like a majority of like chores or other activities. So I've been like laying on a heating pad.
Is there anything in the rule books of tennis saying that you can't toss the ball up with the same hand that you hold your racket in?
I don't think there are any rules about that, but the ball can only touch the racket once. So if I accidentally, like, if it comes into contact with the racket at all during the toss, I can't hit it again.
Does the handle count as part of the racket?
I mean, yes, the handle is part of the racket. The whole racket and your body as well count, like, in tennis. If I were to get hit by the ball, if an opponent shoots, or not shoots, if opponent makes a shot and it hits my person, if it hits my person and it doesn't go back over the net to their side, I lose that point because it technically counts as like a hit or
okay.
a contact for me.
So
I have to headbutt the ball with extreme accuracy to get it back.
Think about it this way. If you could just learn how to have a one-handed backswing, and then...
A one-handed backhand.
Oh, he's
yeah,
just
I actually, yeah, I used to play with that, but if I can't serve, that's like a huge issue.
So with the serve, you just need to hold the ball like with your index, middle, and like kind of thumb as you're holding the handle too, and just throw it up in the air and then use the momentum from that toss to lead into your back, like into the start or source of your serving swing.
One, that sounds incredibly difficult. And two, I might be better off putting the ball in my mouth and trying to like spit it out into the air.
See, I was thinking that you just have your racket in your offhand. You'd slam the ball down really, really hard.
And then switch.
And then switch hands and then jump and then jump into everything.
You guys have definitely come up with some creative solutions, but
the bounce wouldn't be illegal.
Bounce is illegal because it's not table tennis. In table tennis, you can do that.
Ooh, wait. Can you do an underhand serve?
There is also the underhand serve. It's even allowed. Like there are pros. There's one pro in particular. I can't think of what his name is right now, but he has like an underhand serve that he'll just sneak in every once in a while, and it essentially just kills the ball in the service box if he gets it in. And so it's his like last resort to win a point move that he'll do every once in a while.
But like the problem is if you're not doing your quarterback sneak move, so to speak, to sneak that in, if the other person knows you're doing an underhand serve, which by the nature of your body they're going to know, they're just going to go up and smash it. Yeah. It would be catastrophic.
This is, this is dumb. I just looked up to see who had the okay, it is Nick Kyrgios is the underhand serve guy. Like, you should watch a video of him underhand serving sometime. But I just happened to see with the Google search that Huffington Post has an article from 2013. This is, I think, before Kyrgios like really became named the king of the underhanded serve. And the name of the article is it legal? Yes. Ethical? Perhaps. Underhanded? Definitely. It's like, fuck you. Back in my day, when we played stick and hoop, we didn't have no dirty underhanded serves.
I like how it's is it considered underhanded? Yes, because it's literally an underhanded serve.
Yeah, I know. I really like the clever naming convention, but I really hate it when people are like traditionalists for no particular reason. Like, if it fits within the rules, it is an exploitable boundary, in my opinion. So if
you know
I really
thought of that,
huh?
You know who thought that?
Who?
Pretty much everyone playing old school football before they had all the rules.
Yeah.
I've been watching a lot of sports, weird rule sport videos where they go over like, did you know that this is a rule? Do you know this is why this is a rule? And it's always just like an interesting, fascinating story. Like, a player can score a goal. A player can score a goal in basketball for opposing teams on the same game.
Yeah, that
is
basketball
legal.
Like, basketball is actually a favorite reference of mine when we talk about like evolving, not esports, but like sports metas, right? Like, I know jack shit about basketball, so I will be very upfront about that, but I do know that over the like 20 years I've been alive and aware of basketball, the successful approach to a team, or like the team mechanisms that they use to win, have changed dramatically. Like, a 3-point game has become more and more valuable and popular in the NBA, what within the last decade. And before that, it was a lot more like in the key action. I like seeing sports like evolve and change like that. And so the introduction of like people having a more successful, if not also trickier serve to return, the underhanded serve, like, I think it improves the game by making it even more diverse and interesting, as opposed to, can you master these like core elements of the sport that have existed for 50, 60 years, and everybody like turns their nose at more unique or like odd play styles. Like, I like unorthodox play.
Just imagine the first person that tried or that started using the bunt in baseball successfully.
Holy shit. Yeah, exactly. Like, that must have blown people's minds. They're like, but he's not swinging hard. That ball's not going to go anywhere. It's like, yeah, but if you kill it in the middle of the diamond, like, and you're a fast runner, that's a better swing than getting like pop flied out or hitting a bunch of fouls or line driving back into someone's mitt.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Fancy Ramen podcast, where we talk about video games, but every once in a while we will surprise you with the fact that we do
know sports exists.
Yeah, we do have a little knowledge about sports.
Nice. So that's been your week.
That's pretty much me. I think I'm ready to hear what you have to say, Cookie.
Sweet. I joined up with a new D&D group and created a new character. His name is Sully Rightfoot. The backstory behind that is, in his more mischievous days, he used to steal people's left shoes just so they start their day on the right foot. Hey, he's a bard. He's a sneaky little bard. He's a halfling. I'm just excited about him.
There's definitely a high that comes from creating a new character. I, from time to time, will build a new character that, because I end up DMing all the time, I almost never get to use, but it's still so much fun to do. I have a wild magic sorcerer in my back pocket that I'm going to have to use sometime. And for anyone who's not familiar with D&D or doesn't give a shit, it's essentially a character in which a critical failure, like when you use any sort of spell, a critical failure causes you to roll a random effect that can be anywhere from like a life-ending mistake to like banishing someone to a different plane or turning yourself into a potted plant. It is
bananas. Is it a critical failure in 5e?
Every time you roll a spell, if you roll a 1 on a d20, which is a critical failure, then you have to roll from the random effects. Granted, those effects can be positive for you, but they can also be catastrophically bad, too. So.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. In 5e, it is a 1. 3-5, it was like a percentile dice.
Right. And then I think the percentile dice is used for the for the random table, right? Yes. Percentile dice is the D100. So then you roll off of this huge table and there's like a, I shouldn't say a million, there's roughly 50 different things that can happen.
Damn. In, from anywhere from you cast grease centered on yourself to you regain one, you regain 2d10 hit points to you're immune to being intoxicated by alcohol for the next 5d6 days.
Oh yeah. There's a cast like third level fireball on yourself. There is a regain all spell slots, which would be amazing. The potted plant is still probably my favorite. You turn into a potted plant, you're vulnerable to all forms of damage, and you revert to your form once you've been reduced to 0 hit points.
You can't speak for the next minute. Whenever you try, pink bubbles float out of your mouth.
Just it's in very, character, yeah. Right?
Yep.
It happens at the game table, too. It's quite wild. I mean, you pay a lot for the bonus pack because, you know, you do need the soap that you have to eat. But
yeah, no, I guess I like didn't necessarily mean
you. Like, you pour grease on yourself at the table.
I didn't mean so much like with the pink bubbles, but like whether or not you could speak at the table. I guess that's maybe a little too apples to apples D&D style or something. Apples to apples, is that?
I don't know.
One of those.
It's a card game. Apples to oranges is a turn of phrase.
Yeah, it's a card game. I think it's one where like you do a lot of weird stuff in the middle of the game, like kind of similar to like a drinking.
We didn't play test this at all. It is a game that not a lot of people have played, but it is quite literally that. Each card you place down is a new rule in the game. So there are things that raise from at the beginning of your turn, before you place a card, you have to say Comic Sans is awesome, to cake is bad, to yes means no, to up is down, to just cards that say I win. And then it follows with, if you're the only girl at the table, you win. If it's your birthday month, you win. And then cards that just say I lose. And if you play those cards, you just lose.
I think you've brought it up before because this sounds familiar. I could be wrong.
I probably have. It's a great game. If you have not played it, you should definitely play it. But yeah, that was kind of my week. Just getting to create a character. And besides that, it's just been work.
But video games. I guess I can go real quick because I really haven't been playing anything new or all that much in the grand scheme of things, but I did finish The Somnium Files. I have not finished Your Turn to Die. I finished the first chapter, part one and two of that. And okay. Honestly, I in case either of you guys have started playing it or played it or are in the process of playing it, I don't want to spoil anything, but I will note that the game took, it felt like the story had some really interesting twists in store, and those twists ended up not happening, and so I was kind of bummed out by that. But that's not to take away from the fact that the game was still really up to the end of chapter one was pretty satisfying, and I'm definitely looking forward to starting chapter two today. I'm not necessarily in a huge rush because I know the game's not finished yet, and so chapter three might take another year before it's out, and then translated, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like super high on my priority list, but if I find time today, I'll definitely play it. But I finished Eye of the Somnium Files, which I can actually say kind of a bit of the same. This game, being from the makers of the Zero Escape series, I kind of expected it to go in a completely wild and random direction. And it kind of does. But it seems more predictable as you're going through the game. And the game, I think, also does a pretty decent job of preparing you for the resolution, if that makes sense, or what the twist and stuff, the ultimate route, I think, it guides you down that because there aren't nearly as many branching paths. So the game kind of does a better job of showing you each story point in the correct order. Whereas 999, VLR, and Zero Time Dilemma are all three open enough that you can get major story points early enough in the game, in the narrative, that you hit another point later on that doesn't feel as good because you already knew about it, if that makes sense. I's a lot more of like a catered and tailored story. And also, like, I think the writer has gotten a lot better at just writing characters in general, because there's not a single character in this game that I just hate, with like maybe one exception, but I think it's very intended that you're supposed to hate this character. Every character that you meet in that game, like, is written in a way that they aren't completely dislikable, but he gives you reasons to dislike certain characters at the start, only to let them like blossom or justify themselves as you play the game more. And that was definitely something lacking from the trilogy, the previous trilogy. Yeah, it's really satisfying. Kind of sad that like it's over and done with, and it doesn't necessarily go as crazy as the other games, but I think the result is that the Somnium Files is way more approachable for anyone to just go and start playing, whereas Zero Time Dilemma, I think you kind of have to be a little like into that crazy multi-dimensional mindset to even start to appreciate. This game has a much lower hurdle to cross or to get over in order to appreciate the game.
Nice. Glad to hear it.
Approachability is always a plus. Go ahead, Cookie. I can talk more Fire Emblem if necessary, but
okay. I've just been, I've been spending my nights as a dickhead goose, which is fairly enjoyable. It's a nice, relaxing puzzle-esque game where you are just the goose with a to-do list of being an asshole to this small town of people.
It is ultimately like a hit list of inconveniences, right?
Yeah, because you're not actually, I would say, hurting anybody except for the little kid who...
you do who, bite his nose off.
You're quite literally... You're supposed to scare him into a phone booth. You have to make him wear the wrong glasses. And one of the things on my to-do list was make someone buy their own property. So I literally stole his plane, put it into the store, and then when he went to go look for his plane, he found it in the store, and the lady who owns the store is like, hey, you can't steal that. You got to buy it. So you quite literally make him buy his own toy plane.
Are you playing this on Switch?
Yes. This is a nice little right before bed type of thing. It took over our Steven Universe slot of Lizzie just watching me be an asshole goose to these random town people.
Yeah,
it's nice. Not very challenging in some of the puzzles, but a few of them were, like, I still haven't gotten a couple of them solved from, like, the first area, just because I'm not 100% sure how to trigger the events to happen in such a way that allows me to get an item off of a character.
Mm.
Because you are a goose who is still kind of scared.
What is your favorite goof that you have been able to execute so far?
favorite one that I've been able to execute so far. Dressing up. So there's a lady who is painting a portrait, and she's got a porcelain goose that has a bow on it.
Mm-hmm.
So you steal the bow.
Oh, buddy. Why are you still?
So you steal the bow off of the goose, then you hide the goose statue,
mm-hmm.
and then you replace yourself with the goose. So she finds the bow and puts it on you, and then you're a fancy little lad. And besides the goose game, which I wish it was a little bit cheaper to get a little bit more people into it,
mm-hmm.
because I think it's like $20.
Mm-hmm.
$15 would be like a perfect price for it with the amount of content, at least that I've played so far. But besides that, I've been playing more Borderlands 3. And honestly, I don't get a lot of the reviews that I've been hearing about the game, because a lot of people say it's got a shitty story.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be because they don't like, and we talked about this last week, they don't like
the YouTuber,
the bad guys in it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. The YouTubers.
Yes. But like, the more and more I get into the story, the more I'm enjoying the lore that is the Borderlands universe and seeing how characters are connected. Because I've forgotten a lot of like backstory things. So there's a character named Moxie. She is a skinny, big boobs lady who's got who runs the bar.
Mm-hmm.
I learned that. Oh my gosh! Can you guys hear that?
Yeah,
barely.
Okay, I apologize for all the dog.
Please,
no,
it's not your fault. Just bring your dog up to the mic later so he can apologize in person.
But you find out that Moxie is the mother of one of the characters who you interact with on a daily basis, and that she was married to the guy who runs the ammunition shop, Marcus, who picks you up on the bus in the other Borderlands games. And just like some of the twists that have just been happening, it's like, oh, what does that mean for the universe? Because of the whole, like, there can only be 6 sirens in the universe at one time. So you're finding out a little bit more about that because you're dealing with five sirens in this game so far from where I'm at. And I'm on like the third planet,
mm-hmm.
or so, third or fourth planet. And each planet that you visit is deeply rooted in one of the gun manufacturers. So, like, my favorite planet so far has been the Swamp Planet, because it's the Jacobs planet.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually get to meet Jacob, the Jacobs.
Who makes the Jacobs
guns.
Guns, okay. What's their gimmick, by the way? I don't remember the gimmicks from each of the gun makers, but I know they each have one. Like,
Jacobs is they're all the old school six shooter old west wild west guns that do the most damage.
Okay.
But have like the least amount of bullets. Malawan's gonna be like your charge weapons that do elemental damage, which you get to visit that planet.
TDR is the guns that are grenades, right? I think I remember TDR that.
Is the guns that are grenades, yeah. Yes. But yeah, so I've been enjoying the story more and more the farther I get into the game. Can't wait to beat it eventually, one of these days. So, what have you been playing, Scott?
More Fire Emblem, baby. I've finished 2 of 4 possible routes, and I'm just getting into my Black Eagles Church route, which means I'm purposefully under-leveling the shit out of Edelgard and Hubert. Not that that actually impacts, I think, when they come up as enemies because
you get it in one chapter, regardless of what route you take.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what level they are, but it does mean that they'd eat up experience if I use them. So
yes.
Edelgard is like... Well, honestly, even underleveled, she's a very, very good unit. So on the maps that I'm like forced to use her, I just essentially have her survive the map. Like, there's really nothing else that I do with her, and Hubert's been pretty much sidelined, which is much harder to play. I'm playing on the hard mode this time because I know the route well enough. It's much harder to play without those two. They're such good units that it's pretty difficult, and I've gotten maybe only half of the church staff or the Saros knights. And so the other like difficulty I have is now I'm getting these units that I kind of want to be my late game units, but they're underleveled and a little like they're stuck behind my like units from the Black Eagles class somewhat. But it's just like there are definitely some church units that even though I had decided or resolved to use all of the church units as much as possible, I do think that Hanuman is honestly like one of the trashiest units I've used in a Fire Emblem game. He is impossible to keep alive. He doesn't do that much damage. And he's just like, he's immediately in need of so much babying that I think I'm probably just going to drop him behind. Manuela can at least like hold her own in combat and has a lot of utility. But there are a couple of just weird build paths that some of these people are put into. Like the archer black mage combo seems really bad. You should only be doing range damage with one of those options and not like trying to split between the two, especially on a character like Hanuman where their strength is half of their magic. It just makes no sense for them to have a bow, even if like he has a combat art that is reduces the resistance of an opponent. But then that means you have to waste two turns on an enemy doing that or soften them up with that combat art so another mage can do the job. It just feels really weird and like niche in a bad way.
I think the original design is that Pegasus Knights and Flyers in general are supposed to have high resistance to magic but low resistance to arrows. I could be wrong on the Wyvern Riders though.
Or Wyvern? Yeah, Wyvern. I've always said Wyvern. Maybe it's Wyvern. I'm not that sold either way.
Wolvern.
Yes, the Wolvern Riders, the big furry dog-like ones. they have high defense, but they still take extra damage from arrows. So even though they can maybe survive an archer, they're still reduced to like really low health, if not outright killed.
So I understand like that's supposed to be the unit for the existence of people using archers and black magic or any magic, I guess. But black magic bears this example better. But the problem is that in practice, like seldom does that situation ever present itself where you can't just have another unit come in and clean house.
Yes.
So that's the only time like an archer black mage combination even makes any sense. But there are other students that are proficient in both, but like it's never fortuitous for you to ever raise them as both.
Right.
Like, either their own personal growth leans so heavily in strength or magic, one or the other.
And you want to pick one.
Right. And even then, even if you did, there's no point to, because you're going to have an archer unit or, you know, an archer unit in this case, someplace nearby, or a lot of them can be downed if we're talking Pegasus Knights or Falcon Knights. They're usually weak enough to, or like weak enough defense wise to be like annihilated by any of your melee fighters.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand the logic behind it, but just like how dual users in general just don't really work out that well in this game.
Mm-hmm.
With the exception of like weapons, sometimes you can justify having like a sword lance guy.
I think you could theoretically put together a dancer that is both good at swords and magic. But what I've found in most cases is if you give a dancer 11 sword, you can use swords and have all of those bonuses, but you're still only using the magic stat.
Like, yep.
There's no need to like pump the strength then.
And that one magic, is it Spellblade or something? That thing is like killer.
Hexblade or Soulblade. It's one of I think you have either of those options. And they are very good. But once again, it's all magic. You might have an iron sword, but you're just killing the durability to use the combat art.
But what about your war master? Your brawler axe guy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that guy... Well, that's all strength, right? We're still talking, like...
Oh, yeah, I guess you are just talking all strength at that point.
Yeah.
It's apples to oranges, like, totally. And I'm not suggesting they need to model their stat system or battle system after this. But, like, when you think about Dark Souls, like, the dex and strength interactions with your damage, I wish they had something like that in Fire Emblem, where, like, there would be weapons that would actually benefit from both strength and magic.
Mm-hmm. But so far, really, nothing.
Yeah.
But that's okay. The church route, I think once you've done Edelgard's route too, it makes the church route much harder to feel comfortable with following. Because honestly, I've never actually built up the relationship. I think my relationship rank with Rhea passed C rank before, and now I've had the B rank conversation, and it's like, it's creepy. It's honestly really weird. I'm interested to see what happens when you get to A, and I don't actually know if you can get to S or not. I hope not. I mean, I hope that S is not there, but I haven't checked, or I didn't look closely enough.
Hey, so I can't say this out loud since Tiff's in the room?
Yes.
But will you repeat what I just said in chat?
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I absolutely can. I just need to hop out to look at that real quick.
This might be a spoiler to you, Cookie. I'm not sure.
That Rhea is the culmination of all the incest relationships in Fire Emblem?
Yeah, every single one you can think of.
Right, because...
all of them.
What is it? If you're sort of a representative of Sothis, she's technically, like, your progeny, but she's also your, like, mother figure. But, yeah, I mean, it's really weird. And honestly, I think it is... it's even creepier with just... the conversation that you have with Rhea about her being so, like, doting and interested in your affection, but your character, like, these conversations are happening when your character has no, like, your character is always in the dark, very dumb. Byleth is definitely one of our dumbest, like, protagonists thus far in a Fire Emblem game.
And you couldn't even make him / her look dumb.
Well, I don't know. I think they both have pretty blank expressions. I mean, like, male Byleth's standard expression is like, I'm so dumb, I need to furrow my brow and concentrate on what everyone's saying to me. And female Byleth is just like the open eyes, kind of like surprise face all the time. Like, huh? Oh, okay.
That's what that means.
I mean,
it's weird stuff.
Part of the nature of... that character, I'm trying to be vague here, I think justifies that blank state.
You think? Yeah, no, that's true. You're like, I don't know. I definitely understand that. It's nice to have, I guess, something different from the usual, like, intelligent tactician that they have in most of the other games, or even just, like, instinctive warrior from, say, Conquest and Birthright, because normally our Fire Emblem avatars, even from way back in the early games, is like normally a very intelligent person calling all the shots. And in this one, it's like Byleth is a tactical genius in combat. Byleth seems completely like blank, or like personality, or like intelligence-less in conversation and like interpersonal interactions, which makes sense. Like, your character is stunted, and there's even acknowledgement of it. Like, it's intentional. It's just it's interesting. It's weird for a player who's really engaged to, I guess, be tied to that as their avatar or as their character.
So many games do like kind of a weird job in that, as like silent protagonists, where you're supposed to like personify yourself as that person in that game or story,
mm-hmm.
they tend to go with the cop out. It's not even necessarily a cop out, but like they realize because the character's silent, they have to like, or you know, silent amongst other things, they have to kind of write that into the plot.
Mm-hmm.
Like Persona 3 is like a pretty good example of that, where every, you know, people talk about him not talking much and being kind of gloomy, despite like having choices to make yourself more into a jackass or sarcastic, like not so much sarcastic.
But a joker?
I mean, five is a good example, I think, of not having to fall into that same trap.
Mm-hmm.
Like they give you a decent palette at which you can, you know, play your character. And four, I think, to a reasonable extent, there's always some implication that the main character is kind of a jokester in four.
Yeah.
But I'm not necessarily saying it's bad or not, but I kind of wish that maybe they did a better job pushing Byleth into like a specific type of character, or like giving them more personality through the dialogue as opposed to not really having a whole lot,
right?
Intentional or not.
Yeah, I just, it will be interesting to see how this church route resolves, because what I do understand is whatever happens, the Church of Zeros will probably continue to essentially sit on top of Fodlan and I assume maintain the status quo. What's interesting about it is that none of the house leaders, like I believe in this route, will essentially have their changes that they wish to implement upon Fodlan occur, which means you essentially,
it might
like
be the worst.
It could be the worst one. I mean, I assume you
worst from the standpoint of moral founding.
Ah,
moral
fantastic!
Ground.
It is to go with the church blindly is the evil route. Is what I'm feeling, but who knows? I mean, Dimitri seems very dumb. He could be the evil route without ever understanding it. I mean, I know from a spoiler in, I think it is the Black Eagles route, that at least his like faithful manservant Dudu, who I would really like, I am excited to play that route to get to know Dudu, because he is so stoic and like you don't get any character really out of him in any of the other routes. Like his interactions are very small. He doesn't exude a lot of personality. You just know he likes plants and being like very loyal to Dimitri. But he does something that is like definitely a big like ethical no-no in the Black Eagles route for his final, like his final moment on the battlefield.
I would honestly say there's a continuity issue by the, I don't have to get into that. I would say that he becomes more tolerable and likable in that route. But just like the big problem with any of these routes is that like the measure of a character going to the extremes to get to their desired endpoint
depends on whether you sided with them or not.
Yeah, I mean, It's like it's easy to like anyone in any sense of setting. Like it doesn't have to be in video games if they are not being forced to like great extents and stress to accomplish something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know. We were talking about Genghis Khan, but like maybe if Genghis Khan had like a better understanding of cultural domination as opposed to just militaristic expansion.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe if like his country was extremely wealthy and so forth, he might not have been the warmongering tyrant, so to speak. I mean, there are obviously like cultural benefits and so forth. This is a very like, I'm trying to
thread a needle, I know.
the cartoony version of Genghis Khan, because I don't think that's necessarily the fairest representation, but I'm just kind of saying that, like, if he were born in a different context, then maybe he wouldn't have done all the warmongering and so forth, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, I think if you pick up, like, most, I think anthropological, like, focused books, or books that focus on, like, historical culture, I mean, so much of, like, human culture comes out of environment and circumstance, right? Like, you're nomadic if you don't have, like, a huge amount of resources to utilize.
Right.
And that's why you're nomadic. Like, if you did, chances are your culture would develop to exploit and utilize the bountiful resources around you. So it is impossible to, like, try and separate environment from, like, cultural development. They're just completely intertwined in the human experience.
And to reflect this back on Three Houses, like, every single character in that game, every character that is, you know, exclusive to a route, I guess we could say,
mm-hmm.
has that same thing going on, where, like,
they're sculpted from their environment as well.
And based upon what route you choose plays such a heavy influence on the situation that they enter, that, like, I don't think it's fair to necessarily judge people for what they do in the routes that you oppose them in, because, like, by the nature of the situation that you've put them in.
No one, like, seems like they're being unreasonable, I guess.
Like, except maybe one character. referring to one that we have spoken upon heavily already.
Yeah, I mean, the only one I think of, or can think of, and I know that you are, like, you have to be very cautious about what you say to not spoil things. Right. Like, Rhea is the only one that, like, reasonably could be different, but I think could be different prior to the events that, like, shape the entire plot of the game, which is the, like, complete genocide of all of her, like, brothers and sisters. Her entire yeah. people are eliminated, and that explains her, like, need to establish the church and like, have that control over Fodlan. The only problem is, like, I wonder what her character development would be after those that Slither in the Dark are completely eliminated, because then you could see, like, potential, like, softening or loosening of her, like, grip and paranoia on the church and the church's like, establishment of central power in the region. Like, once those who Slither in the Dark are gone, is there a reason for Rhea to be such a zealot about controlling everything?
I mean, I don't know.
Only one way to find out.
It kind of depends, yeah. like, whether the chicken came before the egg or not.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot of stuff that, like, that maybe we'll get more information on in the DLC at the end of the year. But I would much rather prefer a new route.
I mean, with this much exposure to the game now at this point, where we've, I think, collectively put in, like, a couple hundred hours together to explore everything, Fire Emblem Three Houses may feel incomplete, like, sometimes, like, graphically or with the slowdown issues. The story seems, although, like, obviously very muddled from each route that you go, but from, like, exclusively within each route, it actually seems very, like, well constructed. There's nothing I've encountered that's made me think, like, oh, this is a weaker narrative route. I have to agree that, like, the Black Eagles Edelgard ally route is probably the one that I wish were, like, the necessary first experience for the game. Like, if the game unlocked routes after you completed, say, an initial story route, I'd really like for the Edelgard one to be the first.
That'd be a cool way to do
Yeah, there are plenty of games that have done that where it's like, oh, you get this, you need this chunk of the story first for context to really appreciate these other deviations or alternative timelines. Like,
and that's kind of, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. No, I want to hear your feedback.
That's exactly what the Somnium Files does, because you have these branching paths that things get like change very drastically based, like, I mean, it's a murder game. It's a murder mystery. That much is not a spoiler. Mm-hmm. People die in certain routes and people don't die in other routes. And like that game is built around the idea of actually forcing you to go down and witness these bad endings or non-ideal endings.
Mm-hmm.
And like without necessarily fully understanding them until you finally get the big reveal at the end that puts everything else into perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think Three Houses, as you allude to, has like a very, it has some of those moments where I would almost even argue that maybe playing the Black Eagles route last kind of has that sort of effect, because I think
what I worry about is it's a game that you can already put 80 hours into the first route.
That's true.
The chances of, I know that there are games where it's like, it's really not sad, or the ending will never be as satisfying if you don't reach that like secret ending, you know, that like extra bit of background. I imagine Octopath Traveler might be that way. You seem to like, that game's too hard for me. So I'm trying, but like I know you were very excited about talking about the ending after completing all of the endings.
It's totally not, in my opinion, it's not worth playing if you don't hit the last ending.
Right. And
Octopath. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that maybe I would actually feel the same about Three Houses. If I just for some reason chose the Edelgard ally route last and just didn't get to it, I'd be like, the game's okay, but like there's some stuff that's missing. So yeah, it's only by sheer luck that I encountered what I think is like a necessary ending almost to like appreciate the game.
It's tough because it's
a lot to ask for.
Yeah, basically, like if you're only going to play it once, it should definitely be the Edelgard route, the Black mm-hmm. Eagles route. And if you're going to play it multiple times, I mean, even then, because it's such a long game, if you don't blaze through it, like you might not have the added benefit. But if you were marathoning this game, I'd almost say you do every other route first. But then, like, that's a lot of time for,
if you could skip to act two for each
yeah.
house. But there's no, I know that there's no good way to do it.
That'd be amazing to just skip to act two.
But the problem is that I think act two in general doesn't feel as satisfying. Like, I don't mean from a story standpoint.
Without getting to know the characters.
Yeah.
It's just that, like, yeah, so many of the events are written as if they would happen in the first act. And act two just kind of feels like you're going through the motions and you're not really exploring so much anymore.
You get very railroaded, even though you're technically doing the same thing through act one, because you're with a different house leader and your perspective on the events your perspective as Byleth is the same. And if you play those levels over and over, there's almost no change. But your compatriots shape your, I think your compatriots somewhat shape your perspective. And it's the only way to sell like their act two is by spending time with these characters. So I get why you can't skip, but purely from like a time investment, like a player, like considering the player in the real world, do I think, man, that is so much to ask for, to play through the same intro, like the same act one essentially four times. I've done that, you know, I've already done the Fort Joy in Divinity Original Sin probably like 10 times. I really should never do it again when it comes to like Elder Scrolls games or Fallout. It's like there are only so many times I can leave the vault before I just want to just like hit my head against a wall, because I've seen it, I've done it. it feels so wasteful.
But you can place that in about, you can place that in about an hour.
Right, and we're talking about, even if you skip every single cutscene, what, it's like 10 hours of gameplay or something to get out of Act 1? It's a lot.
Yeah.
I kind of want to play Skyrim now and just do the story and see what that game's like. Since we were talking about RPGs, I know, completely off topic thing.
No, I get it.
It's okay. You're gonna boot up Skyrim, get to the first area, and then just start chopping wood.
Become like, a lumberjack.
Yeah, you know what? Maybe I should live an honest life. And you sit down and you increase your blacksmith level to 100, but you never go anywhere from there. You just hope someday that an adventurer will come in needing some dragon bone armor. You'll make a killing and retire.
So I was playing Divinity Original Sin 2 at some point before, and I just wanted to ask, since you mentioned it, I want to bring it up.
Great game. I can always talk about that game, I think.
At what point does it feel like the story hasn't just tossed you in like head first into a pool full of... I don't know where this metaphor is going. My thing was that it was kind of hard for me to approach or to keep my head in the story and game because it almost felt like I was missing an introduction chapter that I was supposed to read to understand the world a little better. Like, it was just like, suddenly I'm expected to know what the term... Oh, God, what was the term?
Sorcerer?
Yeah, source. Specifically source. Like, I felt like I would have enjoyed the boat and intro a little more if I knew what the fuck source meant, or if they had given me like one page of text at least to tell me like, this is what you have and this is why people hate you.
Did you not listen to the intro?
The old lady
video? Talk
about it? Yeah, I did, but it felt less like...
I feel like you actually have to watch that a couple times to like fully understand what's going on. Like, the first time I watched it, I didn't understand it. And it's only after playing Fort Joy 10 more times. So I was like, this is very clear. It makes a lot of sense. But actually, you don't get that context until almost leaving the tutorial island, which once again, when we're talking about like intros taking a while, that tutorial island, you can spend 10 hours on. Maybe,
and I kind of felt like it would have been more beneficial to just have your character have amnesia, like partial amnesia or something. Like, it would have felt more fitting.
What's a Jedi Knight? And then they tell you exclusively what a Jedi Knight is.
I mean, you joke, but like, approach.
No, because it works.
Yeah, KOTOR doesn't have that problem.
Yeah, I agree. It takes a long time to pick up, though. Once you have it, going back and playing again, it's like watching a film for the second or third time and seeing things in the background. You're like, oh, this makes a lot of sense. I just didn't have the knowledge or tools that I do now. Go ahead, please.
I was gonna derail you just for a moment to say, if you turn on the plant modification one that's in there for you to turn on, oh, it makes the game so much easier to farm gold.
Plant modification, what's that?
So there's a list of mods that you can just automatically equip that's just built into the game now, like the 75% walking speed while out of combat.
And the context is they did it right around the Switch release of the game. So they took these popular mods. Yes. And they were just like, if you have Divinity Original Sin on any one of these consoles or systems, here's everybody's favorite mods made by the developers, now just checkbox options in the game.
Nope, they weren't made by the developers.
Oh no, they were just imported from the modding community.
From the modding community, because the plant one is broken.
Mm. What is it exactly?
So you can take a empty bucket and put a plant that can grow into that bucket, and the plant will be harvestable in, I think it's like 4 or 5 turns. Now, if you're in combat, 4 or 5 turns can last a long time.
If you're standing around.
If you're out of combat, it's like 30 seconds.
You can sing Yankee Doodle and it'll be ready.
Yes. And not even 30 seconds. It's like 10, 15 seconds. And then once you cultivate the plant, you will get a bucket full of clay. And there's also a possibility of you receiving a seedling as well. Now, a seedling comes in a bucket of its own. You just have to put the seedling down. So at this point, you are duplicating buckets and these plants that you're only supposed to have one of. So, like, there's only one blood rose, slight spoiler, throughout the game that you can get, but it's like a permanent boost as long as your character doesn't
all
die.
All stats get a, like, plus one.
Plus two. It's plus
Ooh,
two.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So you can literally plant said blood rose into a thing, and now you have two blood roses. And you may have two blood roses plus a seedling, so you've got an extra bucket now. Are the Jarl flower, or no, Jordanane, which is the most expensive plant that you can have.
It's like the
LSD
flower.
You can literally just farm.
Yeah.
Yes. You can farm that LSD flower at the beginning of the game just to have unlimited money, because it's free for you to farm these flowers.
And they're worth a lot.
They are worth a lot. So about 20 minutes of farming and you've got a lot more gold than you actually need.
Some people call it Divinity Original Sin. Cookie calls it Cookie's Drug Empire 2020.
But yeah, so if you do decide to start the game over at some point to play one of the interesting characters rather than your everyman, no offense, that's just a good way to kind of jumpstart. Okay, I need to buy these spells for these characters.
I mean, I guess you can change the stats on, or skills and stats,
yes,
for each of the origin characters.
Exactly. They can, yes, be whatever you want.
Because I kind of wanted, like, a scoundrel, and I wasn't...
You weren't sold on the big lizard being a good sneaker, because he can be just as good of a sneaker.
The Red Prince?
Yeah. Oh, he's a blast. Yeah. At least as a companion character, talking to him has been some of my favorite dialogue in the game.
I guess I imagine he would be more of a flam. Like, when I say flamboyant in nature, I mean like warrior, mage, frontline, something that is proud and noble.
Mm-hmm.
He normally is.
Yeah, I think
he normally
is. I think
is.
If you pick him up, he's, and you don't modify him, he's a knight.
Yes.
I do appreciate that when you pick up people that they ask you what you want them to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yep, because at that point it's like, just because I'm getting fame does not mean that I'm getting a sorcerer. It means I'm getting roughly what I think is going to be an archer or a mm-hmm. scoundrel.
Yeah, you're all rogues. Every single person in my party. You're a rogue, you're a rogue. We're going to cluster together and backstab every large enemy to death.
Four of you just like walk behind one person
just
and all
repeatedly
backstab
shanking
at the same time.
Yeah, there's not enough room in the actual backstab cone to do it, but I'd love to have a strategy where you just take turns in line running up, backstabbing, and then stepping out of the way for the next character's turn to come in and backstab.
So it'd kind of be like a Game of Thrones spoiler, like the assassination of Jon Snow.
Yes.
You just deal with every enemy that way.
Yeah. It's a good game. You will, the one thing to note for those mods, if you activate them, you lose the opportunity for achievements, which achievements have never really mattered too much to me. Yeah. I like to use them as suggestions on like things to try out or do for the named ones. And it's always fun to get something. It's like, this is a secret achievement. Like, no, not that many people find it or know how to get it. Those are cool, but I mean, I think some of the mods really make the game more fun. And
that 75% walking speed nail, it's money. It's money.
Hard to play without.
It is very hard to play
without. It's one of those things where once you do it going back, you're just like, are you walking through mud? Like, are you waist deep in water? Why are you so slow?
My God. You're just slowed all the fucking time. It's like, okay, I'm going to sneak around to get over here. 5 minutes later, I've gone 15
feet. They step into oil, they're practically frozen in time. It's imperceptible.
Oh my God. Getting slowed with the 75% walking speed is annoying for me. And that's just
a normal walking speed.
Walking speed.
Yeah, I don't know if there's much else to say. Do you have anything else, Scott?
Nothing anybody wants to hear.
If you have comments, questions, or corrections, you can write into podcast@fancyramen.com.
Don't forget to leave a like and a review on the Apple Podcast. That's one of the ways that we grow.
And one of the other ways that we grow is if you tell a friend about us, or a family member, or anyone else who would be interested. That is how our audience grows the fastest, like an infinite flower pot trick.
This was episode 133 of Fancy Ramen. Have a great week, everybody.